Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Ed, for that introduction. I'm very pleased to be able to be part of this year's Australian Economic Forum. 2 weeks ago, the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Glenn Stevens, gave a speech in Perth which he titled "Still Interesting Times." Now, one consequence of living in these interesting times is that there's no shortage of interesting things to talk about. There's the inexorable shift of economic weight to Asia, the extreme public debt problems in the North Atlantic economies, the multi-speed nature of the Australian economy, the more conservative approach to spending and borrowing by Australian households, and the list goes on. I'm probably relieved that I don't plan to talk about all these today. Rather, I want to spend my time exploring just one of these issues, and that's the changing patterns in household saving and spending in Australia. This issue is not only interesting in its own right, but understanding these changes helps us understand some of the broader changes that are occurring within the Australian economy at the moment. At the aggregate level, the story on household saving is, I think, by now pretty well known. As you can see from this chart, the aggregate household saving ratio declined significantly from the mid-1980s to the mid-2000s. And then over the past half dozen years, this decline has been reversed, and the aggregate household saving ratio is back to where it was in the mid-1980s. Glenn Stevens has recently spoken at length about why these changes took place. In particular, he drew attention to the fact that as nominal interest rates declined and the availability of credit increased, household spending grew more quickly than income for around a decade or so. And although the adjustment was drawn out, it was by nature a one-off event. So even before the North Atlantic financial crisis, households were returning to more traditional saving patterns, and no doubt the crisis accelerated this return. Now, this aggregate story is interesting, but it can only take us so far in understanding what's really been going on. At the RBA, we spend considerable effort delving underneath these aggregate figures to try and better understand the factors that are affecting individuals' decisions about saving and about spending. One way we do this is to use the HILDA survey, which each year tracks the finances of individual households. While the survey doesn't ask these households about how much they saved each year, we can calculate saving ratios from 2006 onwards using the income and expenditure numbers that are reported in the survey. And having done this, we can compare how the distribution of saving ratios across the population changed between 2006 and 2009, which is the latest year for which data are available. And perhaps the easiest way to summarise the results for you is to show how the median of the distribution has changed over time. So as you can see from the first bar of this chart, the median saving ratio increased by 1 percentage point between 2006 and 2007. It increased by a further 2 percentage points between 2007 and 2008. And in 2009, it jumped by another 4 percentage points. That's a cumulative increase of 7 percentage points over 3 years. And this figure turns out to be quite close to the 8 percentage point increase in the aggregate saving ratio calculated from the national accounts in the graph that I showed you first. These micro-level data suggest the increase in saving has been widespread across the population, and it also confirms that the increase in saving was occurring before the financial crisis, but the crisis saw a marked acceleration of this trend. When we drill down into the data in more detail, an increase in saving ratios are apparent across the entire income distribution. Although perhaps not surprisingly, the increase in saving ratios has been smallest for households with the lowest incomes. Many of these low-income households spend a significant share of their income on the basic necessities, and by virtue of that, they have limited scope to increase the amount of their income that they devote to saving. Another way of looking at this data is by tenure or housing tenure. And this next graph shows that the saving rate has increased for those that rent, for those with a mortgage, and for those that own their dwelling outright. Again, it confirms the increase in saving has been widespread, although the increase in saving has been smallest for the households that own their dwelling outright. This next chart shows how the saving rate has changed for different age groups. It's clear that the increase has been largest for younger households and smallest for the older households. And this result holds for both households that are renting and those that are owner-occupiers. The survey also suggests that younger households have experienced income growth broadly in line with that of other age groups. However, the spending of younger households has not grown as quickly as these other age groups, and hence the relatively large increase in their saving rates. I think taken together, this evidence is consistent with the idea that higher housing prices and debt levels have contributed to a reassessment of saving decisions, though obviously the reasons for the increase in saving go well beyond what's happened in the housing market. Higher housing prices have required higher deposits, and this requires more saving. This trend has probably been reinforced by developments on the lending side, with most lenders lowering their maximum loan-to-value ratios over recent years. Saving decisions today are also likely being influenced by the earlier rise in debt levels relative to incomes and by debt servicing burdens that are staying higher for longer. The adjustments seem to have been particularly pronounced amongst younger households, many of whom are hoping to enter the housing market or who have recently entered the market. There are two other aspects of this individual level data that I'd like to draw your attention to. The first is the relationship between the change in savings and a household's holdings of financial assets. To explore this relationship, we've divided households in each income group into two other groups, those with above average holdings of financial assets and those with below average holdings of financial assets, and then we've calculated the change in the median saving rate for each of these groups. And the results of this are shown in this chart, with the top line showing the median increase in the saving rate for households with high financial assets, and the bottom line showing the change for those with low financial assets. I think it's pretty clear that in all five income quintiles, households that had relatively high levels of financial assets before the financial turmoil increased their saving by more than households with relatively low levels of financial assets. Here, the evidence is consistent with the idea that the fall in financial asset prices over recent years led households to increase their saving out of current income in order to rebuild their asset positions. When share prices fell, household wealth declined, and as a consequence, increased saving has been required to attain any desired level of wealth. This has been particularly the case for households that held a lot of financial assets. In a sense, this experience is the flip side of what happened during the decade to the mid-2000s. During that period, household wealth increased very substantially because of rising asset prices, despite the fact that households were saving relatively little out of their current income. The second aspect of the individual level data that I want to draw your attention to is the relationship between the change in the saving ratio and how much uncertainty a household feels about the future. This is a difficult issue to investigate, but I think it's a very important one, as the financial crisis in 2008-09 illustrated all too clearly. During that period, uncertainty around the world increased greatly, and the result was that both households and businesses delayed discretionary spending and they increased their saving, and the result was an amplification of the global downturn. In the Hilda survey, households that are in employment are asked each year how worried they are about losing their job. And using the responses to this question, we've classified households into four groups: those that have become less worried over time, those that have become a little more worried over time, those that have become a lot more worried over time, and those where there's been no change. And as again, we calculate the change in the median saving ratio for each of these groups, and the results are shown in this graph. It's clear that the largest increase in saving ratios is for those households that have become a lot more concerned about losing their job. And conversely, the smallest increase in saving ratios is for those who have become less concerned about losing their job. I think here the evidence is consistent with the idea that when people become more uncertain, they save more to build up larger buffers against the possibility that something goes wrong later on. It's also consistent with other work that we've done at the Reserve Bank that shows that households that are particularly uncertain about the future tend to spend less of any increase in their current income than to households that are more confident. So in summary, this work on saving using household-level data confirms many of the popular explanations for the recent increase in saving. Higher housing prices and debt levels have had an effect, as have falls in investment portfolios and a general increase in uncertainty. This work also confirms that the increase in saving has been quite widespread across the population. I'd now like to turn from saving to spending and to look at the changes that have been taking place in patterns of household expenditure. The two most comprehensive sources of data in this area are the Quarterly National Accounts and the Household Expenditure Survey, which is currently conducted by the Australian Bureau of Statistics once every 6 years. And the latest survey took place in 2009-10 and was released just a couple of weeks ago. It covered almost 10,000 households, and it classifies expenditure into over 600 individual categories. They range from towels and face washes to road tolls to 10-pin bowling charges, so it's extremely comprehensive. When we look at the longer-term trends from both of these sources, two changes really stand out. The first is a significant rise in the share of total expenditure on housing. You can see that in this chart here. When the Household Expenditure Survey was conducted in the early 1980s, housing accounted for a little less than 13% of total expenditure. By way of contrast, in the recent survey, this figure had increased to 18%. This is the largest change in any single expenditure category. The bulk of the change has taken place over the past decade and largely reflects the rise in interest payments on mortgage debt due to higher levels of debt relative to income. The second longer-term change is a decline in the share of spending on goods and an increase in the share of spending on services. For example, in the early 1980s, spending on clothing, footwear, household equipment, furniture totaled around 14% of total household expenditure. Today, the figure is just over 8%. In contrast, there's been a very substantial rise in the shares of total expenditure accounted for by health, education, and a range of household and personal services. While these increases are partly explained by a rise in the relative price of these services, the volume of consumption has also increased substantially. And these broad trends can be seen right across the entire income distribution, although there are some subtle differences across incomes. The decline in spending on clothing and footwear, for example, is evident across every income group. Conversely, as you can see from this chart, households in all income groups are spending a higher share on services, and the largest increases are evident in expenditure on recreation services such as pay TV and the internet, shown here by the blue bars. In addition, many middle and lower income households have spent a significantly higher share of their expenditure on holidays, shown here as the red bars. It would appear that rising incomes, the appreciation of the exchange rate, and the emergence of low-cost airlines has made travel more affordable for many of us. There's also been a general increase in the share of expenditure devoted to education, and for higher income households, a notable increase in the share of expenditure on household and personal services, shown here by the pink bars. And I think looking forward, it's reasonable to expect that these trends will continue. If I return to the aggregate data, the different trends in spending on goods and services are also evident in the national account, in the national accounts. As you can see here, the differences have been unusually pronounced over the past year. The consumption of goods has increased by around 1.75%. The consumption of services has increased by more than 4%. The relatively weak growth in consumption of goods has led to very subdued trading conditions in many parts of the retail sector. But in contrast, conditions have been better in a number of the service parts of the economy. Again, according to the national accounts, consumption of education services is up 5% over the past year. Recreation and culture is up 7%. Hotels, cafes and restaurants is up 6%. And the consumption of transportation services is up by more than 10%. These outcomes suggest that although households are saving a higher share of their income over the past couple of decades, they've also been prepared to increase their spending on services quite significantly. Exactly why this is so is difficult to pin down. One can't completely rule out the possibility that spending on some goods is being understated due to the increased internet purchases from foreign retailers, though I think this is unlikely to be a particularly large part of the story. Another explanation is that there's been a gradual increase or a gradual shift in household preferences away from goods and towards experiences. This would be consistent with the very strong growth in spending on recreational activities over recent times. A more important factor, though, is likely to have been a strong growth in household income. Over the past year, aggregate household disposable income is up by around 7.5%. And I think this has boosted spending on those services that are quite sensitive to income growth. This increasing importance of consumption of services poses a challenge for us all in tracking overall growth in consumption in real time. The main high-frequency data that we have is on the consumption of goods. Australia has long had a comprehensive retail trade survey. It's published monthly by the ABS, and this survey reports separate results for various types of retail establishments. But the spending measured in this survey currently accounts for only about 1/3 of total consumption, and this is down from around 40% in the early 1980s. Unfortunately, for most services, there are few timely and comprehensive measures of spending. There are, however, a number of high-frequency indicators that the bank tracks, and some of these provide insight into the services part of the economy. To take just one example, there are a variety of monthly indicators of spending on transportation, some of which I'm showing in this chart here. These include the number of litres of petrol sold, the number of domestic flights, the number of international flights, and the number of passengers on certain public transportation networks. On recent times, the data on international flights in particular have provided some timely insight into the relative strength of services consumption, with Australians travelling overseas in ever-increasing numbers. However, while these various partial indicators are useful, they fall well short of being a full substitute for comprehensive and timely measures of services consumption. The ABS's Forward Work Program includes efforts to improve measurement in this area, and the bank strongly supports these efforts. So in conclusion, there are significant changes in saving and spending patterns taking place in Australia. The effects of these changes are probably most pronounced in the retail sector, with both increased saving and a switch towards services lessening growth in consumption of goods. And as a result, conditions are very difficult for many retailers. The increased household saving is, however, a positive development from a national risk management perspective. Households are using some of their income growth to build up bigger financial buffers, and this should hold them in good stead in the uncertain world in which we live. These higher saving rates are likely to be quite persistent, and they represent a return to more traditional patterns. While they partly reflect the ongoing adjustment to the earlier big run-up in housing debt and housing prices, the evidence that I've talked about this morning suggests there are other factors also at play. In particular, many households appear to have increased their saving in response to a decline in equity prices and an increase in uncertainty about the future. I think it's reasonable to expect that at some point the impact of these factors will begin to wane, although exactly when remains an open question. So the Reserve Bank continues to monitor these trends very carefully, both at the national level and at the micro level. And over the period ahead, the way in which households respond to the global uncertainties and the continuing growth in their incomes will no doubt have an important bearing on developments in the Australian economy. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
So we're open to questions now. Who's going to be first?
Thanks very much. Tim Harcourt from Austrade. I had a quick question that I think both Philip and Don, with their cumulative wisdom, could answer. First of all, with Philip's talk, is perhaps the what you outlined part of a pattern of a rational response to relative price shifts in the world? That is, with relatively high interest rates and a relatively high exchange rate in Australia, it's quite natural, given demand patterns, that we'll export to Asia, buy online from America, imports, and we'll take our holidays in Italy. And what we're seeing is just a natural, rational response of consumers and businesses in Australia to that structural shift in relative prices due to the coming on of the emerging economies. And as part of that answer, I thought Don Stemmer could come up with the Don Stemmer Factor X that may change that response to relative prices, or indeed if there's a Factor X that may affect that long-term trend in relative prices. Thank you.
Part of what's going on is a response to relative price, and I think you see that very clearly in international travel, where the number of Australians travelling overseas has really skyrocketed over the past couple of years. But there are some other things that I think are a bit more puzzling, because the relative price of goods has come down quite a lot. I mean, if you look through the CPI, the prices of most goods are no higher than they were 10 years ago. And that's really the effect of the higher exchange rate delivering cheaper goods to Australian households. Yet despite the prices of goods, of footwear, of clothing, of furniture being no higher than they were 10 years ago, we are not buying that many of them. And so I think there is something more fundamental going on than just relative prices, and perhaps it's a shift in preferences over time. That's certainly one possible explanation. And I think the strong income growth is also a factor, that services tend to be more responsive to income growth, and we've seen over the past decade very strong income growth in Australia, stronger than in most other countries. And as a result of that, people are buying more services. So there's partly a relative price thing, it's partly an income thing.
I like the fact that Tim has asked us to think about the cycle in saving and the trend in saving, because I think it's very important to make that distinction and see what's happening to each. I think the abnormal period for Australia was probably the period about the mid-90s through to about 2004, when the saving rate fell so much. There were very special factors. People were pumped up about how trendy it was to borrow against the increased value of your house and spend it on consumption. But I think Australians are going to stay fairly high saving. And I'd have a question for Phil, if we have time later. What do you see as the benefits of this for Australia? And the reason I ask that question goes back to 1962. In 1962, I was a young tutor at the University of New England when a lot of Colombo Plan students were coming to Australia. And although people have forgotten that now, it was one of the best things Australia ever did. And I'd given a tutorial on the paradox of thrift. And I remember three students, one from Singapore and two from Malaysia, stayed back after the tutorial. It was easy to do at the University of New England. There wasn't much else to do in Armidale then. They stayed back after the tutorial, and their question was, are you saying saving is not a good thing? Now, that wasn't really what the paradox of thrift was about, but I think Australia sort of took this funny attitude that saving was a bad thing. I'm in favour of saving, but I'd like to hear Phil on that if he has time later.
Well, do you want to respond now?
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly possible that you can save too much. I would not describe that as the situation that we're currently in. The rate of saving now has really returned to something that we saw before the mid-1980s, and I think we're going to stay at around a net saving rate of somewhere kind of 10, 11, 12%. And if we do, I think that's a good thing, because it's building up buffers in the financial sector, it's reducing risk, so building up buffers in the household sector, reducing risk that the household sector faces. And I agree with you that the period between the mid-1990s and the mid-2000s was a very unusual period. We were collectively adjusting to lower nominal interest rates and increased availability of credit and spending almost every dollar of extra income that we got on consumption. That can't continue, and it shouldn't have continued. And we've really been in a process of adjustment since the mid-2000s and accelerated by the financial crisis. And I think it's a good thing from a risk management perspective for the country as a whole. I think the only other observation I'd make here is that kind of, if you look across countries now, Australian saving is kind of in the middle of the pack for a developed country. What really stands us apart is the high investment for a developed country. I think it's quite likely that over the next couple of years, the investment ratio in Australia will be the highest it has been for 50 years. No other developed country can say that. So we're saving a fair amount, but we're also investing a huge amount, and that's very good for our long-term prospects.
Michael Knox, RBS Morgans. My question is to Phil Lowe. A few months ago, I unusually, for me, had to do a presentation using that kind of data that you had there about the savings rate going up. And it seemed to me that when I looked through other parts of the RBA chart book, that the variable that had the most relationship was when the household debt service ratio went up to about when interest payments were about 12 or 13% of household income. That seemed to be the ceiling, that when households hit that level of debt service, and that happened back in 2005 and 2006, it was the response to that of sort of, we can't finance any more debt, that caused them to increase savings from the very, very low level that it was. Have you thought about that area or have any views on that?
I think it's certainly the case that the higher levels of debt that many of us are carrying around have, over recent years, led us to save more. I think for many years, people thought the right investment strategy was go to the bank, borrow as much as the bank would lend you, and then growth in your nominal income over time would reduce the debt servicing burden. And when you had high inflation, that was probably the right strategy. In a low inflation environment, borrowing as much as the bank will lend you may not be the right strategy. And I think many of us have, over time, realised that our debt burdens are not declining as quickly as we thought they might. And as a result of that, we're having to save more out of our current income. I don't know that it's kind of mechanical, kind of we hit some certain level and then we had a collective adjustment, but I think as a society, we've kind of gradually learned the lesson here and we've gone back to kind of more traditional forms of saving. And that's certainly a large part of the story, but I think the declines in asset prices and the greater uncertainty that we all feel about the future is also playing a role at the moment.
I'm Rick Sundalini from the New South Wales Treasury. I was very interested in this reference to the golden age of reform that Don mentioned, and that somehow that had finished and there was no future golden age yet to come. Maybe there is one coming forward. I was wondering whether you could perhaps explain more why you see, what are the factors behind that? And there has been some debate about, you know, the quality of our policy debate in Australia, about our political discourse, the role of media, whether the whole approach of governments to implement policy is not focusing on a process which delivers sustainable policy reforms. Or do you see the golden age as just that there was some low-hanging fruit, we've had that, there's no more room? I'm just wondering if you can explain why you think that golden age is no longer going to be there, we can't find those reforms, when you see a need for reform, you know, everywhere in transport, in aged care, in climate change. So just your thoughts. And Philip, if you've got a thought as well on this one, I think it's a fundamental issue, given the role of the Economic Society about public debate. It's a statement I wouldn't mind you elaborating a bit further on.
It's a very, very important question, and I did simplify a little. I'm not saying that all reforms stop then, or there's not an appetite or not hard work being done to introduce another round of reforms. But I think there's another explanation why Australia had that exceptional period of reform from 1982 through to 2004. The Economist recently did its survey on Australia, and it was written by, it was published in late May. I thought it was quite an outstanding survey. It was written by a guy called Johnny Grimmond, who also wrote the survey on Australia in the beginning of 1987. And in 1987, he took quite an optimistic view of it on Australia. And you had to be pretty brave to take an optimistic view on Australia. It was within, 7 months of the Banana Republic comment by Paul Keating. And he summarised his optimism in one sentence, which was, if you look at history, Australia's one of the best managers of adversity in the world and the world's worst manager of prosperity. And I think there's still a lot in that. And it's basically the history of farmers and miners, isn't it? That they are very, very good at coping with adversity, but they don't do so well in prosperity. And I think that's Australia's biggest problem. To be fair, the Hawke-Keating government in 83 was quite exceptional. I mean, do you think what happened in 1983, that's within 12 months of... Oh, sorry, within 18 months of taking office, it reintroduced the income and asset test for the age pension, just did it, and it floated the Australian dollar and then allowed foreign banks in soon afterwards. I mean, it was an exceptional period of change. And to be fair, the early days of the Howard Costello government had a number of reforms, but there was that appetite for reform. I think it's harder now because people don't have a crisis, they don't have the adverse times to support governments, and also some of the low-hanging fruit was picked. Though I have to say, very few people saw the float of the dollar coming up and the immediate abolition of exchange control. They were huge moves. And just the way that the present government won the 2007 election, it had to go back on a lot of some liberalisations of the labour market. But, you know, I think some of the big ones coming up, defence procurement. I mean, why is Australia going to build diesel submarines in Adelaide at such huge cost? I mean, those things are so damn dumb that I hope we can avoid some of those things. But a lot of it, like, try to reform taxis in New South Wales and... You know, you just know how difficult it is. So I think there'll be some good efforts. And I just finished my comments to your question by saying, through thick and thin, we've had the Productivity Commission. We wouldn't have got as far as we've got without our Productivity Commission. When you visit countries like Japan, China, the United States, there's nothing like our Productivity Commission for taking an assessment and getting things through to the public. So we've still got some things going for us. Probably, though, we'll need a period of adversity to make another round of reforms.
Productivity ultimately comes from how businesses operate, and the public policy framework can affect that, but it's not the only thing that matters. The kind of the individual incentives that the business faces, I think, are also important. And my sense is, from talking to businesses around the country at the moment, there's a renewed vigour in finding new ways of doing things. Because particularly those businesses in the slower part of the economy are finding conditions much more difficult than they have for really a decade. And that's leading them to rethink about their business practices, about the amount of capital they're using, the current technology. And we're seeing, I think we're seeing in our business liaison some signs that businesses are tooling up. They've decided they've got to move forward with technology, or they've got to examine long-standing business practices. So I think there's some cause for optimism, even without any change in public policy, that the private businesses are actually looking to do things better. And if that's the case, then we'll see a pickup in productivity growth. But I agree with Don about the Productivity Commission. I think it's an incredibly valuable institution for the country. If you read through its reports over the last 5 years, there's a very long list of public policy issues that could be tackled, and we need to listen to what they've got to say.
Don, I thought focusing on the death of the cycle was sort of interesting, because if you come to Australia today and look ahead for the next decade, I think the common view is the cycle is dead. Right? I mean, if you ask people, when do they think unemployment in Australia will go to 8%? Which, after all, is not unusual for America or Europe. And they won't say next year, they won't say the year after. You'll probably get hardly anybody that'll say in the next decade. Because what seems to be built in is this view that, you know, the China growth is going to be so strong and so continuous that we'll have a really good decade. And you can sort of believe that, except the US is in trouble and will not recover quickly. Europe's in trouble and will not recover quickly. So you just sort of feel, looking back over history, it's got to come sometime here. Or would you say, forget about it, it's just gone, it's just a new world, and we've just got a glorious decade in which you're prepared to bet the unemployment rate doesn't go above 6, for example?
I think when you get to my age, Bob, and as you pointed out, you've got about 6 weeks to start on me, but always there's a bigger cycle in the future than people allow at the time. China, I believe, has got a bigger cycle in its past than a lot of people realise. People look at the annual figures from China, but if China's had quite a few ups and downs in its cycle in the post-Deng era. The best thing for Australia to happen would be for the Chinese and the US cycles to stay out of sync. And that's happening at present, and that's actually a good thing for Australia, and I don't think we pay enough attention to that. If China and the US can keep their cycles out of sync, that would be good for us. The biggest risk for us is silly policies at home, by whichever government's in power, if power's not too polite a word for the things at present. But if we had some silly policies at home and China hit a brick wall... Now, I think China's got a lot of advantages in managing its economy. It's not finding it easy to switch spending from exports and investment to consumer spending, but it's got a fairly strong political motive to do that. I also think macroeconomic policy is easier when you've got $3 trillion US dollars of international reserves. You're not having to make panic actions. But I think the risks for China, not long term, but China having a cycle, are greater than is generally realised. And one of the things you'd love to do as you get older is to be a counter-cyclical investor. And, you know, I reckon looking back on all the years I've been involved in investing, the biggest mistake people make in investing is to take the latest phase of the cycle and extrapolate it ahead as a trend. So, Bob, I'm sitting on cash. Some stage in the next 5 years, I've also got a lot of inflation-linked government bonds because I'm fearful of global inflation and the cycle in global inflation if you look 5 to 7 years out. But there'll come a time China's economy will slow. Maybe there'll be 12 months with growth of only 3 or 4%. And do you know what the Western press will do? It will give up totally on the China story and will not recognise it as a cyclical low. So I'm sitting on some cash because if you think BHP and Rio are good long-term investments now, just wait till China has a period of 3% growth. Think how cheap they'll be. So I agree with you. I'm not smart enough to know what will drive the cycle, but I think we'll see the cash rate over 7.5%, unemployment over 8%, inflation over 6% at various times in the next 5 to 7 years.
Well, I think kind of in general Australia is moving out on the risk-return frontier. So that means that the potential growth of the economy because of what's going in China, I think, has picked up. And that's going to be a long-term trend, but kind of China followed by India and Indonesia, they're kind of incredibly important markets for us. And I think in expectation they have very good medium-term prospects and we will benefit from that. So that's the high return. But those countries also tend to have quite large business cycles, as Don said, and commodity prices are notoriously volatile. And while they've moved up a lot, and I think a lot of that's going to be highly persistent, there will be a cycle there. So if 70% of our trade going to Asia and more than 50% in commodities, we will have cycles as well. So we're under no illusion that we're going to have smooth sailing kind of for indefinitely. We'll have business cycles here. And the question is, how do we best respond to that? What type of institutions, what type of arrangements do we put in place to deal with that? And there the flexibility of the exchange rate is incredibly important, the credibility of the monetary policy arrangements, the ability of fiscal policy to respond quickly and decisively if that's needed, and a flexible labour market. They're all key elements of dealing with the inevitable business cycles that we'll have here. But I think, compared to many other countries, we're in a very good place to deal with those cycles because we have the fiscal flexibility. We have a credible monetary policy framework. The labour market's working reasonably well. And we've got a flexible exchange rate. So that puts us in very good stead to deal with these cycles.
Plus the high saving rate.
The high saving rate helps a lot as well, yeah.